This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening. This is Claudine Cheong here.
And I'm Bart Vanderwerf.
On today's edition of The Informer, we hear about research into conversion therapy and the ex-gay movement in Australia. Earlier today, Bart and I spoke to Dr. Tim Jones, a historian at La Trobe University, who is doing a pilot research study on Australians' experiences with the ex-gay movement. I asked him what the study hopes to discover.
So we were working with Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria and the Human Rights Law Centre to look at the whole spectrum of practices associated with gay conversion therapy and the ex-gay movement more broadly in Australia.
Actually, I might go back a step and say I think I've seen a few different terms here. I've seen conversion therapy and reparative therapy. So what's, yeah. Do they refer to the same thing?
Well, there's a whole spectrum of different kinds of activities, programs, ideologies that might be generally clumped together under the idea of the ex-gay movement. Mm-hmm. So there's formal individual therapy, sometimes called reparative therapy or conversion therapy, which is aimed at changing people's sexual orientation. But then there's a whole group of other kinds of activities, self-help groups, spiritual healing groups, and other kinds of medical interventions. And there's really nothing more than anecdotal evidence about what's going on in Australia. And we've only just started this research and we've already been really surprised at the diversity of experiences that people are having in practices associated with ex-gay.
All right. Now, your research is also about a religious aspect of this. Is this a typical religious phenomena?
Yeah. So in the middle of the 20th century, mainstream medicine, psychology, psychiatry saw same-sex attraction as a symptom of mental illness. But progressively from the 1970s, professional medical and psychological organizations began to remove homosexuality and transgender, different gender identities from classifications of mental illness. And it's about that time from the 1970s that religious groups started to develop their own ways to deal with people who are same-sex attracted.
So do you think that's a coincidence, or is it actually a response to the changing of the medical profession and their approach?
I think it's a direct response to the depathologization of sexual orientation and gender identity from mainstream medicine.
So what's currently known about the ex-gay movement in Australia in particular?
Well, as I said, there's been very little formal study of it. So most of what we know is anecdotal. We know that it happens, that people from all different kind of religious backgrounds have engaged in efforts to change their sexual orientation. And we know that it's mostly people who want to change or deal with their sexual orientation because of conflict with religious beliefs. And there's a diversity of different kinds of practices associated with this, from quite sort of extreme medical interventions involving shock therapy to self-help groups to private counselling to group counselling to kind of pastoral communications within religious groups with religious leaders.
And do you know if it's ever used by people who aren't from religious backgrounds, or is it solely religious backgrounds?
We haven't found anyone in sort of recent times who's been seeking to change their sexual orientation or gender identity without religious motives, but that may be the case. I guess the real point of this research is that so little is known about conservative attempt to change sexual orientation or gender identity that we just really that's why we're doing this pilot study, to find out what exactly is going on.
You mentioned earlier medical interventions like ECT. How is that? Are those actually practiced by medical practitioners?
Yeah, so we've had one or two reports of people having shock therapy in an aversive kind of way, so not ECT, which is stimulating the brain directly, but are sort of building up negative associations with erotic imagery, building up aversions to particular erotic stimuli. That's probably the most extreme end, and we wouldn't expect that much of that is going on, although that was mainstream medical practice in the 1960s. Oh.
But wouldn't that be against their code of conduct now?
Yes, that would definitely be.
So, Tim, I've also heard that they used nausea-inducing medication in these therapies as well. Is that something you came across too?
So in a previous research project, I've looked at the development of different kinds of sexual orientation change therapies, and a variety of different aversive therapies were used in the 1960s and 1970s in Australia. Some of them were using electrical stimuli as aversive agents. They did also use emetics, which made people feel nauseated or want to vomit, as aversive stimuli. But they were really pretty conclusively shown to not be effective quite early on, and certainly by the 1970s, that fell out of mainstream practice.
Now, the advocates of conversion therapy will, of course, tell you that it works. What kind of proof do we have that it actually is effective or not?
Yeah, well, the key to the studies that have argued that various different ex-gay therapies work is what their measure of success is. And their measure of success isn't actually a change of sexual orientation, so moving from same-sex desire into predominantly opposite-sex desire. It's actually a behavioural measure, so it's about not acting on same-sex desire. So it's about the elimination of same-sex desire rather than the adoption or the emergence of a heterosexual sexual orientation.
And how hard is it to conduct research about the effectiveness of conversion therapy? Because it seems to me that it is very subjective.
Yeah, there have been a number of different studies that have been conducted in the US, and the literature there is fairly conclusive about the nature of the result.
Have you ever heard of Robert Spitzer?
Yes, yeah.
So what can you tell us about Robert Spitzer?
So Spitzer's a fascinating character. He was involved in the depathologization of homosexuality in the 1970s, but then in the early 2000s, he published a study saying that perhaps ex-gay therapies could work, and argued that they did have some impact. But again, as I referred to, the measure of impact wasn't actually change in sexual orientation. It was a behavioral measure. So it was about reduction of same-sex desire. It wasn't actually about inhabiting a heterosexual subjectivity.
And what I've heard also from the study is that it was based upon interviews that were conducted by phone interviews.
Yes. So the study, there were various methodological criticisms of the study about the kind of the selection of candidates in particular, I think is the most damning selection. They were all participants referred from ex-gay organisations who obviously had a motivation to show their therapies in its best light.
So tell us about your research. What does that involve?
Yeah, so we're hoping to interview people in Australia who've had any kind of involvement in a practice, a group, a formal therapy that might fall under the big umbrella of the ex-gay movement. We're interested in interviewing people from all kinds of religious and social backgrounds, from all kinds of sexual orientation and gender identity perspectives. We really want to find out what's been going on in Australia involved and what the impact that the various ex-gay activities has had on people's lives. So in the pilot study stage, we're hoping to do interviews with people. So we'll talk to people for an hour or two about their experiences, and then we'll decide, or, you know, once we've got a sense of what has been going on and how it's been changing in Australia over the last couple of decades, we'll evaluate the initial research and decide what's the best way to move forward from there.
Yeah, is there a potential of being re-traumatized in the process of talking about these experiences?
Yeah, we want to be very careful to make sure that people who are participating have the appropriate support and have the appropriate capacity to talk about their experiences. A lot of people anecdotally have found the pressures to negotiate their sexual identity in a religious context quite difficult and traumatic. For other people have reported that it's just been a sort of stepping stone to coming out. So there's a variety of different emotional responses. But we certainly want to be careful, and we don't want to do any harm in the process of interviewing, absolutely.
So how can people participate or find out more about the study?
So they can get in touch with me at La Trobe. Just send me an email or give me a call, and we'll do a little scoping interview to see if their experiences are appropriate for the study and go from there.
Thank you so much, Tim.
No problem. My pleasure.
That was Tim Jones from La Trobe University, who is interviewing Australians who have been involved with the ex-gay movement. If you want to learn more about this study, go to our website after this show and we'll have Tim's contact details there. And if you have been troubled by listening to this or at any time during this program, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or QLife on 1800 184 527. And if you've got anything to share with us about this topic, email us on air at joy.org.au or text the studio on 0427 JOY949. And now we've got Nathan Despot in the studio with us. Nathan is the policy director of the Australian Equality Party, and he produced the Inside Ex-Gay radio series with Dean Beck, which aired on Joy in 2014. Thanks for joining us, Nathan.
Thanks.
I might start by asking, what's been your experience with the ex-gay movement?
Yeah, so I spent most of my 20s going through some form of ex-gay process, whether it be going through therapy with ex-gay practitioners or being part of the ex-gay conference circuit, as well as being part of a regular evangelical Christian church, where the messaging and part of the culture when it came to coming forward as being same-sex attracted was that there was something wrong with you, and you know, I was told that I was loved and I was embraced and I was in leadership in many areas of that church, and it was just understood that I would be dealing with my same-sex attraction in my own private way in the background, and when I needed help I would come and speak to the leaders, but for the most part I'd go off and go to the conferences and the group projects and what have you. So,
all right. And what led you to create the Inside X radio series?
So I guess, you know, after being, having gone to Bible college and having been in church for so long and having been through some really horrendous experiences and coming out the other end, I guess, fairly okay and alive, it was a bit of a shock to realize that so many of the people that I met in the years following my engagement with ex-gay, so many people that had been on the same journey as me in that in their 20s had not come off as well. And so people had taken their lives, or they were things like long-term unemployment and disadvantage, and people just really couldn't get themselves together after that experience of walking away from ex-gay. And I found that there was this whole host of you know, theological professors that I had from Bible college and church leaders and people who were coming forward to me secretly saying, I'm actually now, I don't believe in the evangelical view of homosexuality anymore. And yeah, so I just want to let you know, Nathan, that I support you. And I thought, well, would you mind saying that on radio? and quite a few of them did.
That's good. So Tim earlier told us about some very harsh methods that they use during this therapy. Is that your own experience as well, or what kind of methods that they use?
Yeah, Tim and I have had some interesting conversations about that. And I think my perspective would be, and I agree with a lot of, I love what Tim's doing, and I've been a part of the project that has led to Tim's work taking place and Tim's research. And I think when it comes to harsh methods, there's a difference between, you know, electroshock or simply being told you're evil and you're a poofter and a faggot and you're going to hell, all those horrible, harsh things that you might hear in a really homophobic environment. People who go through those experiences, they do suffer a lot. But also, if you're part of a church for a long time, say decades, and every day you're hearing this message gently injected into you and you're marinating in this message of there's something wrong with you, something went wrong with your childhood and with your parenting, you know, that actually has been shown to be just as harmful. So I went through that sort of soft stuff, but I also had those periods of where I'd find myself at conferences and people would be trying to cast demons out of me and quite aggressive kind of evangelical stuff. So
I was going to ask earlier, how easy or difficult was it to find you know, allies and people like professors and ministers to appear on the series Inside X-Gay?
I guess it was a challenge at first. Some people like suggested the idea to me, actually. Some of them suggested the idea. But as we found with, for example, the last interview, which was with Nicole Connor, who's who was in a senior ministry role at Victoria's largest church and whose husband is still there, well, actually has recently resigned from being the senior minister there. The vitriol that Nicole received when she went on air was quite horrendous, and there's been it was quite dramatic, actually. And I think those people like Nicole, have a lot of support around them. They really do at the moment. But they also go through some horrendous stuff when they come forward. And it really does show you how much fear there is out there relating to same-sex attraction, or, you know, anyone who's LGBTIQ. If you're in a conservative religious environment where you've been told some very consistent, solid things about our community over, well, centuries, really. So, yeah.
So how do you, if you're in that environment, how do you get out of it? What is there a sort of turning point where you decide that that's not going to work?
I think it's, you know, it's a combination of things that slowly begin to become obvious. So for me, it was the fact that I began to realize that people who were helping me through my journey of becoming straight, they seemed more interested. The issue wasn't so much on making me whole and helping me be healed from my same-sex brokenness. It was more about just, you can't be gay, and anything we've got to tell you to make sure you don't live that lifestyle. So I began to realize that the messaging was much more about the fear and superstition and much less about caring for me. But also just seeing that it didn't work, that my feelings weren't changing, that I was, you know, a lot of the therapy was good and I felt like a healthier person on many other levels, but I was, you know, just as gay as I'd ever been. I think also noticing a lot of the leaders of the worldwide ex-gay ministries came forward, you know, caught in gay bars or renouncing the ministries they'd been a part of. Yeah. There was basically, you know, a huge collection of things that came together. But I think also seeing the sense of merciless treatment of people who really couldn't handle the ex-gay therapy, and the harm they were experiencing, and just the lack of compassion towards them, was really quite startling. So
now we know that conversion therapy now is banned in Victoria, but it doesn't eradicate the problem officially. So what we know is that it's probably now underground.
Well, it's not actually banned. What's banned is essentially claiming to deliver a form of therapy or some sort of clinical service where you're claiming to be representing, say, or working in the auspices of psychology or psychiatry. Yep. and making the claim, for example, that you can change someone's sexuality. Mm. What's not controlled is the fact that two of the largest Christian radio stations in Australia, which are based in Melbourne and Geelong, still broadcast Focus on the Family content most evenings, which has got that soft ex-gay messaging in it that we were talking about before, which I believe causes harm and definitely caused the suicides of two of my friends. What's not banned is the ability to make the claim that if someone is same-sex attracted, then there's something deeply wrong with them psychologically. So there's no sort of vilification rules that prevent people saying that in media. There's still conferences that can be held. You can still claim to be just a pastor doing pastoral care with somebody and probably get away with that quietly. So the ex-gay culture and a movement still has teeth in Victoria. I think the point of the legislation that's been passed recently, the Health Complaints Commission legislation, which is wonderful, by the way, and it's a fantastic move, I think it more sends the message that this is not acceptable. But from my point of view, working with a lot of young people who are struggling to reconcile faith and sexuality and who are still quite struggling with poor mental health, it doesn't really help them. The symbol doesn't help them. What they need is safety.
Yep.
and support from more religious leaders who are actually pro-gay to come forward with that view that they support LGBTI people. So.
Do you think there are churches and Christian communities that are changing in their attitudes? Do you think there is general movement in that direction?
Oh, absolutely. There are large churches, with mega churches in Victoria, and many of the pastors have conversations with me. And, you know, for better or worse, I won't say their names, even though I'd love to. It would probably cause a stir, and would probably cause harm to the people that I'm associated with in those communities. But there are conversations happening. I think what's happening is that many of the leaders and theological authorities at some of our most conservative Bible colleges are asking these questions or have already changed their mind. But they're afraid of their constituents and afraid of the backlash from their church members. But definitely there is change happening. So, yeah.
And what is the next step? So you've done the ex-gay radio series. What's your next thing?
So we have a few more interviews in the works, actually, for this year, which are being planned at the moment. The group I run with my friend Brian is called the Brave Network. If you like details about it, you can call in and get those details, but we don't give out the details freely. And that's, I guess, a support network for people from an evangelical background. There's also a group called Freedom to Be, which has been a huge part of my journey and healing and wholeness, and it's been like a beautiful family for me. In terms of advocacy, there are things happening in the background, some of them I can't talk about, but definitely working on having evangelical leaders come forward to express their views and their change of heart is the most important thing that's being worked on at the moment. So,
yes, there's a lot. I mean, understandably, there's a few conversations that can't be made public at this stage, but it sounds like there's still a lot going on, that it's bubbling away, and we'll.
I know it sounds very it sounds dramatic and clandestine and melodramatic. I know, to say, oh, this is secret, but many people, it's their lives and their livelihoods at stake.
And so, it's still pretty new for a lot of people, I think, in the churches to come to grips with this. So thanks for giving us a bit of background and an update, and we'll have links to some of that information on our podcast, which will be going up very soon.
No worries. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're on the Informer, Joy's new current affairs program. And if any of the discussion tonight has been troubling, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or QLife on 1800 184 527. Up next, we'll find out the latest news from the UK with Will Stroud from Attitude talking to James Finlay.
Joining us in the UK to find out what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere is the web editor for Attitude magazine, Will Stroud. Good morning, Will.
Good morning to you, James. Very nice to speak to you.
Likewise, as always. Now, tell us, there's a fair bit of baking that may not or may have been happening in Northern Ireland and causing some controversy.
Yes, absolutely. Well, this is an update on a sort of an ongoing row in Northern Ireland. It's been a sort of big legal test case for LGBT equality laws here in the UK. And basically, it all started when 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, next Monday, a gay man named Gareth Lee went to a bakery, Asher's Baking Company in Belfast, and placed an order for a cake with actually had a picture of Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street on it with a same-sex marriage slogan. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the original bromance. Another company took the order and paid the money, and then basically reneged and said, actually, we're not going to bake this cake. It's a Christian-run bakery chain. It goes against their beliefs. Obviously, Mr. Lee took them to court, saying this breached equality legislation. Now, actually, last year, a judge did rule that the bakery had been in breach of the UK Equality Act and equality legislation and fined the bakery. But today they have actually been gone back to court because they are officially launching an appeal against this decision. Now, the bakery argued that they would have not placed this order for anyone, and Mr. Lee's sexuality was immaterial to their decision. That they wouldn't have baked a cake with a same-sex marriage slogan on it for anyone. And so technically they are not discriminating against a gay person. It's more that the actual content of the cake, which seems to be the issue here.
So really what we're finding out is they actually just really, really dislike Bert and Ernie.
absolutely. They just don't want Bert and Ernie to be happy, and a lot of time and money has gone into this. It has been a sort of real test case of equality legislation. Obviously, not been a clean cut case, because of the whole sort of grey area surrounding the content of the cake.
I kind of find myself sitting on the fence with this one because I don't actually know where I stand. Like on one side, sure, I don't think anyone should be discriminating against a gay couple or a same-sex couple that want to get married. But then on the other hand, I really don't want a homophobe baking my cake anyway.
Well, yeah, this is also the other issue, absolutely. Obviously it was a sort of politically minded cake, but, certainly wasn't a wedding cake, which I guess you wouldn't want being made by Asher's Baking Company anyway. That much has been made clear over the last couple of years.
Well, you know, hopefully they just go out of business then, you know. But mind you, I don't think Northern Ireland's getting any closer to marriage equality anyway anytime soon, so I don't think they've got to worry about it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the more and more of these cases we see coming out of Northern Ireland, sort of more frustrating it gets, you know, for people, you know, Northern Irish people and around the UK. We had the local elections last week, which the Democratic Union Party remain the biggest party in the Northern Ireland Assembly. Yeah. And they're, you know, still vehemently anti-same-sex marriage. So it's, you know, we are really seeing sort of Northern Ireland being ghettoized in terms of, you know, these LGBT vows that keep erupting left, right, and centre.
Unbelievable. And last year there was a huge case involving NHS and sexual health clinic, and some final kind of comedowns have come from that.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is someone, last September it was, that had a very bad day at the office at one of London's leading sexual health clinics, 56 Dean Street. It's, you know, in the heart of Soho, you know, it's a, you know, lots of members of the London gay community.
It's a wonderful clinic. I've been there several times.
It is. It absolutely is. It's cutting edge, and they do a wonderful job there. But yeah, this was an unfortunate mistake where someone on an email to people had been coming to an HIV clinic. And we've probably all done it at various points, that they didn't blind copy the people into the email, which ended up in basically the email names and email addresses of almost 800 patients being sent to each other, completely visible. And obviously, you know, when people are attending a local clinic, as you can imagine, you know, people know names on that list. And
sure.
A great deal of upset and anguish. You know, obviously the clinic apologized, absolutely mortified, understandably. But they've had the sort of investigation wrap up just today, and it's, you know, despite the fact it's obviously an honest mistake on their behalf, it's, you know, been called a serious breach of the law in terms of the handling of that kind of data. And the NHS Trust that runs the clinic has actually been fined £180,000. For that mistake. So obviously, you know, it's a bit of controversy because it's unlikely any of that, you know, compensation will go to the people involved.
No.
Obviously, a very expensive email. For that poor staff member to have sent last September.
Oh, dear. Well, yeah, sometimes when I get an email that people forget to do the BCC, I really wonder what's wrong with humanity. Thank you so much for this week's update, Will. We will chat to you next week.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you to tonight's guests, Tim Jones and Nathan Despot. For a podcast of today's program and our other stories, visit joy.org.au/TheInformer. I'm Claudine.
And I'm Bart van der Werf. The Informer will be back tomorrow at 6:30. Up next is Worldwide Wave with more international news.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.